From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. You are you, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. So, guys, how are we feeling?
Feeling good.
Pretty good.
Feeling good.
I'm a little worried.
Trepidatious?
Feeling something just weighing on me because the research that we've been doing for this episode we're about to record, it gets into the deep dark levels of your soul, almost.
Yeah, you know, whenever we go into an examination of history, what we find is that although history is often portrayed as a concrete, inarguable thing, it's much more like a conversation and at times an argument between narratives.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, the saying about history is written by the victors or whatever. Mm-hmm. So a lot of revisionism going on, mm-hmm. depending on, you know, the perspective that you're looking at.
Yeah. In the history of the exploration of where we come from, you know, of the mysteries that surround the origins of humanity.
And it always brings to mind one of my favorite William Faulkner quotes. He said that the past isn't over. It isn't even past. And I think we forget how often history in the world we live in is a palimpsest. A palimpsest is just the fancy word for a thing that a lot of monasteries used to do when paper was very expensive and rare, or they were using scrolls. Vellum, I guess. Instead of buying more paper to write something, what they would do is they would erase what was written earlier and they would write over it.
Yeah.
And fast forward several centuries, historians and researchers found out that it was possible to read the earlier copies, the parts of history that had literally been overwritten through the tactile clues, just the impressions that the earlier pens or quills made on the physical paper. And a lot of times when we look at history, when we're exploring different versions of history or arguments, we're using in a very strange way, we're using clues that are like the indentations of those earlier stories on physical paper. We're finding references that don't make sense. We're connecting dots that have not been connected. And this is, regardless of how you feel about a specific case, this is one of the most important parts of historical scholarship.
Absolutely.
So today, we're not just talking about history for funsies, right?
No.
Today we are diving into one of the, I would say one of the most prominent, conflicts in historical narratives. And we are not doing it alone.
We have with us today a very important person, that exists within the narrative, that we will be exploring. And I think the best thing possibly to do is just to introduce her, mm-hmm. and then let her tell us about herself.
Yeah.
So let's do it.
So welcome to the show, Tansy Bagent.
Thank you. Hi. Welcome.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Tansy. Why are you here today?
So I'm here today to talk a little bit about what my father did, what he dedicated a lot of his life to. And that was the exploration of history and looking for new ways to view history, new ways to think about history rather than just believing the perceived views of the masses.
Yes, in 1982, Tansy, your father, Michael Bagent, wrote a world-changing book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And earlier when you had reached out to us, this was thrilling for us because this is a book that even if people haven't read it or haven't heard of it, people are probably very familiar with the idea here. We checked out a copy of the book, and this is, if we're going to let the badger out of the bag here.
Already?
All right. We've got more than one bag. We've got many badgers, right? This book focuses on an exploration of what the Holy Grail in biblical lore actually was. And it delves into the early days of the Christian church. It delves into nothing less than the secret history of Christ.
Yes, and specifically whether or not Jesus actually died when he, you know, historically died, at least what the texts say, and then whether or not he actually had a bloodline that continued on. In France, I believe, the Merovingian line. Fascinating stuff. And Tansy, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I mean, to start, really, you have to think about, you know, what do you believe? Do you think that a Jewish man would have married, had children, and attempted to gain the throne? Or would he have been born to a virgin, walked on water, and risen from the dead? So I think when you think about history, you have to think about these things. The book begins basically with a priest called Sonia, who in 1885 took residence of a church at Rennes-le-Château, and he discovered something which amassed him a great fortune. And my father and two of his companions sought to find out what the source of his treasure was. This led him on a journey through history. And the question that I raised before, you know, what is your belief, that stimulated this whole journey, really. He wanted to know the man behind Jesus. And in doing that, he looked at how we have translated some of the early texts. And you have something called San Graal, which people translated as the Holy Grail. But if you move the G, it becomes Sang Real, which is holy blood. And that was something that my father did. And explored through that actually Jesus could have had a child, and that child existed and his bloodline existed throughout history.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a quotation in the book that follows this where one thing that the authors do, as you mentioned, Tansy, Michael wrote this along with his colleagues Henry Lincoln and Richard Lee. They say, just as you said, that Sangreal, could translate to royal or holy blood. And the authors say in this book, they say, in itself, such wordplay might be provocative, but hardly conclusive. Taken in conjunction with the emphasis on genealogy and lineage, however, there's not much room for doubt. And they go on to explore some of the blood-related lore surrounding the idea of the Grail, the cup that caught Jesus's blood, right, becoming the Holy Grail. And one of the arguments here is that instead this is, as you said, Tansy, a bloodline. And I really appreciate the point you're making about the actual belief system.
Which, right? Is more likely, I mean, right, to, like, for a man to have married and looked, mm-hmm, sought some sort of influence and power, mm-hmm, or for some of these more mystical interpretations.
Yeah.
And again, it's about faith. It's about which one you see as being, you know, the most tied to your belief system, I suppose. But it's interesting to explore both sides for sure. So when you talk about him, the idea of him, you know, ascending to the throne or like having some sort of bloodline, what does that look like? What would that actually functionally, what purpose would that serve?
So there is the thought that Jesus was from the sort of Solomon and David line, which were already entitled to the King of Jews and to that throne. And so when he was thought to have died, or when he lived on, the plan was to assert that bloodline back onto the throne. So they had an entitlement to that throne. So his bloodline had an entitlement to the throne. And the plan was to protect that bloodline. And then you have these sort of secret societies that come up throughout history that were potentially bequest with the protection of this bloodline.
Hmm. And the main one discussed, and at least one of the main ones discussed in the book, is a group known as the Priory of Sion, which is, you know, there are questions as to whether or not this group actually existed in the way that is outlined in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that and about some of the kind of questions regarding some of this history and whether we're looking at, you know, things that have been gleaned from documents that were not entirely accurate, or if this was more of a 20th century creation. I know a lot of that kind of came up after the book was published, and I know your father was working with information that was, you know, seemed to be accurate at the time. But where do you kind of land on, you know, what is and isn't maybe entirely accurate in the book?
The thing is that at the time, it was 1982, and my father was relying on the information that was available to him then. But at the same time, he doesn't just make an assumption based on one piece of evidence or one document. He takes a multitude of documents and together creates this theory. And so the Priory of Sion and the Order of Sion, they came about, you know, whether or not that they existed in the way that he described at the time. You know, there was actually the Mount of Sion back in Jerusalem, and there was a lot of links and coincidences that make it seem plausible that there was some kind of group. And whether or not, you know, the dossier to secrets has been, more evidence has, you know, changed or documents have changed. He didn't just rely on one aspect. And at the same time, you know, what he came up with was conjecture. There isn't any, you know, we don't have any solid proof of really anything that far back. So you have to just go on, you know, bits of information that you have, tie it together and see whether what you come up with makes sense and is a viable theory, which he still believed and maintained at the end that it was. He followed that and also, you know, had the belief that Jesus didn't die on the cross. And that came through with later books that he came back to.
Speaking of, there are so many novels that your father wrote and about such a diverse topics. We were just looking through some of them about going back to a similar thing, the Messianic legacy, the temple and the lodge, when we get into Freemasonry, which is something we'll jump into here in a moment. The Jesus Papers, Dead Sea Scrolls deception, the Elixir and the Stone, which is specifically about alchemy and magic, seems extremely interesting, but, you know, I have not read it for this interview, but that is definitely on my list now. There's all Racing Towards Armageddon is another one that I really want to talk about. Is it too much to jump gears here?
Well, no, I was just going to maybe say what about all of these topics, these kind of like mystical pursuits fascinated your father so much? I mean, it seems like it wasn't, obviously it is a diverse set of topics, but they all do kind of tie into this quest for the unknown and, like, you know, some of the same things that drive us here on the show. I mean, growing up with them, what were your perceptions of what drove him to these kind of like quests, I guess?
Well, I think what drove him to these quests was the pursuit of truth. He always used to maintain that, you know, you always need to ask questions, you always need to look for answers, and you need to fear no one in your pursuit of truth. And so I grew up being very open to a variety of different ideas and not willing to just take something at face value. He was also very interested in experience. And so he gave me a copy of the Hermetica, you know, when it a few years ago. And he was very interested in the whole, you know, what actually made up existence, what was the truth of reality and what was the truth of sort of non-reality, the things that we can't see. And growing up with that and, you know, meditating from a young age was really interesting to me and has changed my life. He felt that, you know, the most important thing was to, you know, not to take anything, I guess, at face value, not to just be led by what people tell you or what's written in scriptures, and to actually experience for yourself. And I think that drove his pursuit in all of his different books. And they all have that sort of the link to the mystery, the mystical.
And one thing that I really appreciate you mentioning, the emphasis on your father's pursuit and his emphasis on experiential learning, because he did travel widely. And when we're thinking about journeys, this makes me think, you know, when I originally started reading the book, I thought this is the culmination of years of research and work. But in a very real way, it was just the beginning of a journey for him, because this book became internationally known and became the subject of a lot of debate and controversy. So I guess my next question would be something that I've been very curious about. After the publication of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, What was your father's journey in the public sphere like? Because he spoke about the book, he made appearances, he defended things, right? And I was hoping that you could tell us and the audience a little bit more about the journey that he took and the path the publication of this book set him upon.
So I guess the publication of this book was his first sort of real presence in the limelight, and being in that position, he got a lot of, I guess, inquiries and criticism. And I think he had to very much sort of change the way that he presented himself. But he was always a very private man. He'd had a very difficult childhood. And so he wasn't averse to this sort of controversy and the negativity that ensued. Coming out with that sort of information, what it did, I think, you know, they were all very taken aback by how successful and popular the book was and became. That wasn't his, you know, initial idea. They just, you know, it was a 5-year project that they released, and they had no idea that it would be such a success. And I think what that did was it, you know, authenticated him as an author and a historian and a researcher. And that led him into the realms of a lot of other books and investigating things. And he was, you know, in my head, he was very much a real life sort of Harrison Ford character.
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones, you know, he, in order to do a lot of the research, you know, he used to take us all around the world. We'd go to Israel and Scotland and look at graves and churches. And it changed the way that he was in his life. He was a photographer before then. And so to be in that realm of writing books, of investigating, of being in the public eye, you know, it changed the way that he acted and he was. And it made him more committed to pursuing the truth and the ideas behind things and the research behind it. But he was a very private man. You know, he kept himself very separate because he received a lot of death threats.
Your father was a war photographer in Laos, I believe, during the Vietnam War. And I wonder how much that experience led him even further into this realm of wanting to question the truth and you know, question what is presented as truth.
Yeah. So during his time in Laos, he went to be a war photographer. But when he arrived, the two men that he was supposed to meet had been unfortunately blown up. So he took to photographing on his own accord. And through that, he saw some horrific sights. And he was actually approached by the CIA. And they, what they were doing at the time was they were taking and buying a lot of the photographs of war photographers so that they couldn't be shown to the general public. He refused to sell them. So he still has a lot of these photographs. And he also saw some things that were absolutely sort of stricken off from history that were said would never happen. And he saw those firsthand. So I think that realization that what, you know, the public is fed is not necessarily what is actually happening. And I think that led him into his investigations of Holy Blood and Holy Grail and all the others that came after.
Wow. Sorry, I'm just processing that.
No, that's interesting. I kind of thought that's where you were heading when you were saying they tried to buy the photos off of him, because even now you hear accounts like on public radio of war photographers who, you know, like they're asked to turn their cameras off at certain times, you know, and only photograph certain things. So you really do get this skewed perspective of something as horrific as a war. And when it's managed by the people in charge, you really are, it's a very easy way to be led astray into thinking what people want you to think rather than what is actually true. And so I could totally see how that experience would lead him to really want to take deep dives into stuff they don't want you to know.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's a very good point, because although it was suppressed from the public eye at the time, later evidence emerged that shows the U.S. conducted, at least just the U.S., without even counting European powers, conducted extensive illegal operations or black ops in Laos, where numerous mines still remain, active landmines, and Cambodia and Myanmar or Burma. These are not theories, and I feel like it's very important to establish that for the listening audience. These are proven facts. The most made up thing about at least the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam was the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
I think it's so cool and interesting that you kind of cast your father in this light of this like real life Indiana Jones character, because something that we're going to get to next is his sort of embroilment, I guess, with Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code books. And that character is sort of cast in a similar light. So I think we should talk a little bit more about that after we take a quick break.
And we're back. Before the break, Noel said something, a series of phrases that I'm sure piqued the interest of the audience members there, and that is the Da Vinci Code. I guarantee you guys that somebody, several people probably, were listening to the beginning of this interview and going, huh, that story sounds familiar.
Yeah.
That idea of a secret bloodline of Christ, and it is
protected familiar. By some sort of mystical, esoteric secret mm-hmm. society. Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, Tom Hanks is involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's a really charming guy.
He's a good looking man.
He's involved in a lot of things.
I think it's mostly his affect, and he's just very generous with his personality.
I would have enjoyed the Da Vinci Code as a film. I would have enjoyed it more if it had been Tom Hanks as David S. Pumpkins. Exploring it.
If only.
If right? only. But we bring this up because this was one of the biggest controversies, correct? Dan Brown published this book.
In 2003, I want to say. That mm-hmm. might not be correct, but I think that is.
So decades later.
Yes.
Holy Blood, Holy Grail is already out, internationally known. Again, it's the subject of no small amount of controversy, mm-hmm. right? And it has many proponents. It has many opponents. And Dan Brown comes out with the Da Vinci Code and says, so people around the world go, hey, you based that off of, maybe not quite plagiarized, but you based it off of Holy Blood and Holy Grail, to which Dan Brown replied, nuh-uh.
Not just Dan Brown, the publisher, and it became a thing.
And so our first question for this, after that long introduction with this to set the scene. Our first question regarding this, Tansy, is could you give us an account of how this transpired and what actually happened with the arguments that Dan Brown and his publishers were making?
Yeah, so essentially Dan Brown promoted himself as a bit of a pseudo-historian. And a lot of people felt that he was the one who'd done all the research for his book. Essentially, what he was saying is that he'd never read the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, or if he had, he'd only sort of dabbled with it. What transpired in court was that he had actually had the book open at the time of writing the central parts of his book. Lee Teabing is an anagram of Lee and Bajant. So that character was sort of based on the works, I guess, of the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and Lee Teabing takes the copy of the book off the shelf. What my dad felt was that this wasn't enough of an acknowledgement of his work that he spent 5 years with others doing, and that Dan Brown had, you know, taken hold of this information and recast it and stated it as his own and didn't essentially say that much of it had come from the Holy Blood and Holy Grail. Gail Rebuck, who is head of Random House, also was there, and she, you know, it was that he was actually suing the publishers, not Dan Brown himself. They were also his publishers. And
oh, wow.
They essentially did everything that they could to bankrupt my father throughout it by hiring QCs and essentially trying to make him stop pursuing the case. What also came through was the fact that actually Dan Brown didn't do any of his own research. It all came from Blythe, his wife. His wife did all of the research for every one of his books. He didn't actually do any of them. So the judge commented that he was basically a passive observer in terms of the collection of that historical material. He just created the story around it. But unfortunately, because of a technical error that our lawyers made early on in the case, that ended up being a substantive issue in why we lost. But, you know, the judges, especially in the Court of Appeal, held up the book and said the title is the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. It's quite clear that Dan Brown has copied, you know, that aspect of it. And, you know, through that as well, as we had the judge who created his own Smithy Code in the judgment, and he has since been considered a very appalling judge and uses his own bias to pursue his own aims.
So your father and Mr. Lee then appealed the judgment, right?
Yes, because of the fact that actually the original judge, Justice Peter Smith, in his judgment, it was very confused, and he made a lot of statements that suggested that my father was hiding money. And a lot of the reasoning behind his judgment was not actually based on you know, the evidence in the case. We also felt that Dan Brown lied from the beginning of the case until the end. So he continually said, "I don't know, I don't remember." And he didn't remember anything he'd done 2 years before. All of his work and all of his research was destroyed in a flood. So both of his computers were destroyed in a flood. But my father, who wrote the book, you know, 20 years before, could recount pretty much everything that came about with writing the book. So we felt that the judge wrongly allowed that, you know, the fact that Dan Brown had sworn under oath, had lied under oath, and felt that that was a big issue. The fact that Blythe Brown wouldn't appear was a big issue. And the fact that we felt that it was quite clear that Dan Brown had used a lot of the information in the Holy Blood, the Holy Grail, and hadn't correctly attributed it to my father. And then that's why we took it to the Court of Appeal.
And in the end, this really did cost your father, your family, a lot of money.
And I'm sure emotional distress, I can't even imagine drawing something like that out. And obviously your father was one to stick by his guns, and I'm sure he felt very passionate about defending his work. Obviously it wasn't necessarily about making a ton of money as it was kind of defending his name. Am I characterizing that correctly?
Yes, that's right. I mean, he took the case before the success of the Da Vinci Code, so he didn't realize the success that it would be. It was actually just to be awarded the necessary connection to the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and the fact that he had spent 5 years with others writing that book. That was why he pursued the case.
So regardless of whether somebody believes this this account or this exploration, regardless of whether somebody disagrees with the ideas presented, right, by Michael Bagent, there is an inarguable connection between the Da Vinci Code and this book. We have a quote that we'll read quickly here. This is, in my opinion, the heart of the hypothesis, summed up, okay? Perhaps the Magdalene, that elusive woman in the Gospels, was in fact Jesus' wife. Perhaps their union produced offspring. After the crucifixion, perhaps the Magdalene, with at least one child, was smuggled to Gaul, where established Jewish communities had already existed and where, in consequence, she might have found a refuge. Perhaps there was, in short, a hereditary bloodline descended directly from Jesus. This is like, there's no way to say that these are not connected. It just seems very, it seems implausible that an author like Dan Brown, could have in a vacuum written that kind of thing.
One of the most compelling things that came out of the ruling was the way the judge viewed the work Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And one of the reasons that it was said to not be Dan Brown's work was not plagiarizing your father's was because your father's work was like this historical work rather than fiction.
Yeah. So what they said essentially was that you can't copyright historical facts. And even those facts that have a shroud of creativity cannot be copyrighted. So they felt that what my father had done was he'd taken facts, he'd shrouded it in this creativity, that then that shroud could not be copyrighted. It actually reduced copywriting law to basically things like imagery or completely unrelated sort of ideas that were very personal. It made it so that you could quite easily copy someone else's work if it was a sort of a general creation based on facts.
Wow.
Just circling back a little bit about the controversial nature of this work, whether, you know, I mean, obviously calling it nonfiction could potentially make it potentially more controversial than having it be fiction. But there were issues of, I think, the Roman Catholic Church banning the book in certain circles and, you know, calling for it to be retracted or in some way as a work of history, because basically it goes against their entire doctrine, you know, that Jesus Christ had a son and married, and is a totally different interpretation of the way they would have us see that figure. I'm wondering that specifically, how did that manifest itself, this religious kind of zealotry coming at you and your family when this book was published?
So my father received a lot of death threats when we were growing up, and he felt he was, you know, hugely affected by the strength of the sort of aggression of the church, really. They couldn't coordinate, they couldn't blend these two ideas. They couldn't see, you know, Christ being this, you know, real historical figure that could have had a wife and child, and, you know, chose to purely adopt what they'd taken from their dogma and their doctrine. And so, you know, it was, I think, in AD 335 that Jesus was proclaimed as this godlike figure in Constantinople. Actually, if we go back in history, we don't really have a full grasp of history. So what is sort of nonfiction and fiction, you know, whether what he's saying is true or not, but it's just about understanding why he's created it and where it's come from. And I think what the church failed to see was that there could be a blend here, that you could still see this character of Jesus and, you know, all his spiritual teachings and the importance of that, but still see him as a man. Whereas a lot of these people just could not accept it. And they felt that his work, whether fiction or not, incited so much interest, and they just retaliated against that to such a degree that I don't think that my father was quite expecting it at the time. Because again, for him, it was, you know, it was conjecture, it was just a theory, and there's not many theories that can create that much stir. So we felt almost that they were taking a bit of truth from it, and that's why they really pushed against it.
Oh, I was going to say, this also isn't the first example of this idea of Jesus having married Mary Magdalene or having had a relationship with her. There's, you know, the Martin Scorsese film, The Last Temptation of Christ, which was based on a novel from the 1950s by a Greek author that sets out this scenario more in kind of like a storytelling fashion rather than trying to claim that it's based on any kind of historical documents. Did your father ever consider that work at all when he was working on this, or, you know, kind of was, I'm sure he was aware of it, but did that play in any way into his, you know, interest into seeking this out? I'm just wondering.
Quite possibly. He did a lot of research around and would have known about all the different texts that were available. He never said that his theory specifically to him or to his colleagues was that Jesus had a wife. It was the bloodline that came from them.
Yeah, and he does use very careful language in parts of the book. When we read the summation of that hypothesis, you know, he says perhaps. There's indication, you know, at that point when the hypothesis is phrased, he is not telling people what to believe. He's putting these dots together and then continuing an exploration. And Noel, I love that you bring up, that this, their older beliefs, evolving similar things, because this goes back as far as, the 13th century, when people were claiming that part of the Catharist belief was that there was an earthly Jesus Christ who also had a relationship with Mary Magdalene. But when we talk about that, we also have to remember, you know, this can seem controversial today in 2017, but it wasn't that long ago when people were literally being murdered for saying anything slightly different from the official doctrine of the church. I mean, in the span of human history, that's like a – that was me snapping my fingers. Yeah. I forgot people can't see us.
It's a blip.
Well, and things like that are still happening today, not necessarily with the Catholic Church or, you know, Christian organizations, but they are occurring today.
That's true. And we've talked a little bit about the way the church reacted, but we know that many people in academia also reacted adversely to this. There were historians who said that they had serious problems with the book, or they felt that it was not doing due diligence to other things that they considered historical fact. Now, I do want to say at the top here that Matt, Noel, and I are not historians, unless you guys had a – anybody have a wild weekend?
I mean, I watch some great courses every now and then.
There we go. But we do want to ask, how did your father react to the academic controversy surrounding this book, or the criticisms that he received? So not just the ideologically based death threats, perhaps, but the secular conversations.
So from the academic community, essentially his book was considered, because it wasn't nonfiction or fiction, the way that they had written it was very different to how a lot of books had been written in 1982. You had to do a set structure in order for it to be a nonfiction, or a set structure in order for it to be a fiction. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to create this story that brought in facts and their interpretation. And a lot of academics found that not to their liking. And a lot of historians were very critical of his work and the work of Ian Lincoln. But the thing is that, you know, my father was an incredible researcher. He was very intelligent. He was very intellectual. He is one of the most intellectual men I have ever met, and most mystical. And I haven't found another researcher who has gone to the lengths that he went to in order to compile the necessary work for all of his books. He would go down caves. He spoke French and would read all sorts of documents. He investigated things to the nth degree. And it's easy for a person to criticize work, but to actually be the one to write it, to be the one to research it, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of commitment. And all he was doing was presenting facts and an interpretation, a potential interpretation of what they were. He never tried to make anyone else believe what he found. He said it's up to everyone else to draw their own conclusions. And that was his response as well to these other authorities who were trying to sort of contest the work he did. And he just stood by that.
I want to jump into something that we kind of mentioned early on in this episode. Your father was a member of a group that has experienced its own controversies, and this is the Freemasons, the Order of Freemasonry. He was, at least according to MasonryToday.com, he was a member of Lodge Economy Number 76 in Winchester, and he served as Grand Officer in the United Grand Lodge of England. That sounds awesome. I don't know what it means, but it sounds awesome. And he also served as an editor of the Masonic magazine Freemasonry Today. And there's a website that exists for Freemasonry Today, and you can see writing by your father. And it's very, very fascinating stuff. Lots of esoteric, I mean, I guess that's just the nature of Freemasonry, but lots of very high level thinking about consciousness and about religion and the afterlife. And I just wonder how much this world that your father existed in influenced all the other things, and then perhaps even you.
Well, he was very interested in the esoteric, and I think that formulated his own journey in Freemasonry. There's a lot of Freemasons who disregard a lot of the ritual, a lot of the meaning behind the ritual as well. And I think that what he wanted to do was pursue the esoteric aspects of it. Anyone can join Freemasonry. You don't have to be bound by a religion. And so he found it was an amazing melting pot of different people with diverse ideas, this single belief in this other realm, or this oneness that connects all of us. And that's something that he brought through from his work, and also from who he was as a young man and the experiences that he had. And he brought that into Freemasonry in his own way, and tailored his role as editor to incorporate a lot of that. And in my own life, he got us meditating from a young age. He never, ever told us to pursue any religion or any type of spiritual belief. He would always assert that there was many paths to the top of the mountain, and we had our choice to pursue whichever one we wished. I actually started as an atheist. I then became agnostic. I had my own experiences, and that's when I spoke to my father about where I could go from there, and he introduced me to a lot of different religions. I tried Sufism and Wiccan and paganism until I realized that actually I was my own guide and my own path was to the top of the mountain. I didn't have to be part of any religion. And so in that way, I did find that connection to the one and to, and, you know, he helped me in that process, but he was in no way a sort of full influencer of that. He let me guide myself.
Tansy, are you familiar with Pierre Plantard? He was a figure in kind of French politics who was kind of like considered a hoaxer type and, you know, sort of like believed in certain mystical beliefs as well in a similar way to your father. But he's the one who kind of claimed that he was responsible for sort of trumping up some of the Priory of Sion stuff and, you know, kind of directly criticized Holy Blood, Holy Grail when it came out, saying that, you know, it was a work of fiction, and he kind of discounted some of the texts that it was based on and kind of said that he made the story up basically. But he also has kind of been debunked in many ways as well. And it's just interesting, you know, he's someone who kind of prides themselves on always, you know, getting the last laugh. He strikes me as that type. I was just wondering if you were familiar with that situation and his role in any of this. Because, and also, like, you talk about your father being a Mason and kind of having this mind and this fascination with the idea of mysticism and not necessarily religion, but just more the idea of what's beyond the veil, you know, in more of a universal kind of sense, like with the meditation. And one of the criticisms I think that's been levied against him about this book is that he maybe let some of that stand in the way of seeing the facts. And I'm just wondering how you might respond to that. That was one thing that this Pierre Plantard gentleman said, is that, you know, he might have allowed himself to be taken for a ride because he wanted to believe. And we run into this all the time on our show.
So Pierre Plantard was relevant to the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. And I think that the work that he did there, I think that there was links between that and what my father did. But my father also had a huge amount of other sources. And I think that the overarching idea that he came up with, this Holy Blood, Holy Grail, this Holy Blood that ran through time, I don't think has a connection to the mystical in that sense. And so I don't think that actually it did affect his work in that way or clouded his judgment. I think he was seen quite clearly. And I don't think it even matters that, you know, if Plantard was discredited or in any way, I still think that his theory stands up to scrutiny. And I think, again, you know, when you're dealing with historical information, you just cannot be 100% sure. So you just have to find what seems right to you. And again, you know, my father was never trying to tell people what to believe. That was not his purpose. He was just presenting facts, presenting his interpretation and providing a theory. Whether you agree with him or not is up to you.
Wow. So your father was really focusing on that divine world. He called it many things, at least in interviews that I've heard him speaking about it. It's the whatever plane exists just beyond this physical one, where every human being goes to upon death, and from where every person comes before they are born, right? This, a lot in throughout all these different religions, you have a place called heaven or Elysium, Hades, the Duat. There's, you know, pick a religion, there's an other world. And so I'm hearing that perhaps through meditation, you personally get to experience that, at least in some part. Is that something that anyone listening can attempt?
Absolutely. So I'm a meditation teacher, and I try to not bring too much of these deep spiritual ideas into my meditation classes, but they come in naturally. I think that the purpose of meditating and being still, you find a deeper connection to each other and to yourself. And in that place of stillness, you can start to feel and observe a different sense of reality. And whether you wish to pursue that or not, I think meditation is an incredible skill in tapping into that oneness and the connection with us all.
So we have several narrative threads going on right now for this interview, and we have so much stuff to explore, and we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. I'd like to explore something that we mentioned earlier, Matt. I believe you mentioned that Mr. Bagent was a prolific author.
Right? Oh, yes.
So we've explored Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the arguments within. But as Matt mentioned earlier in the show, Michael Bagent did not write just one book. He was quite a prolific author. He wrote a book that particularly interests me and probably interests longtime listeners as well, Secret Germany, which examines the occult practices of the Nazi Party in the World War II era. He also wrote a book that, Matt, you were very interested in.
Oh, yes. Nazis are always a hot topic on this show, and all of those the beliefs and movements that went behind them, especially magic, man. UFOs and magic and Nazis. That's like some of the most interesting things you can talk about. All right. So another book I really was fascinated by that your father wrote was called Racing Towards Armageddon. And that's not the full title, but that's, you know, the gist of what it was getting into. And in this, he explores religious fundamentalism and
That's not relevant at all today.
Right? And but especially the intertwining narratives of the end times of all the various major religions, like how they believe the end of the world will come about and everyone ascending, you know, either into their version of heaven or everyone converting to their religion. And I was listening to an interview with him, and man, it sounded to me like he believed we are getting very close to the end times. Are you seeing that at all?
Yeah. Well, what was very interesting is that actually when he was out in Israel, he saw a photographer who took photos of these very big warehouses. And when he asked the photographer what was in them, he said there are a huge amount of arms owned by the Americans. And this was a place near Armageddon, which is where they believe Armageddon will happen. And I think his work through that book was talking about how these fundamentalists are trying to pursue their own aims and bring us towards the end of the world. And with the amount of tragedies that have occurred recently with fundamentalists, you know, pushing against the system constantly, you know, I feel that there is a worry that the end is certainly closer than we would want. And what he felt was that, you know, he said, is it time perhaps for the religions of the book to throw away the book and seek spiritual experience rather than settling for mere belief? And I think that's where he wanted to go. He felt that, you know, democracy and he felt that faith in people and who we were as humans, he felt that needed to be stronger than these archaic sort of beliefs that guide people towards death and doom.
Yeah, that's exactly what we were talking about earlier, getting back to things like the Kabbalah or classical mysticism or Sufism, where it's all about that personal connection with the other side rather than someone standing on a pulpit telling you how it is. I don't know. That speaks to me, at least personally.
Tanzi, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today and to speak with our listeners as well. And one thing that we like to end the show on whenever we examine historical allegations or anything related to the past is we like to ask about the future. So where do you see the future of research into these sorts of theories going over the next few years? Is this a done deal, or is there more to be discovered?
So there was a lot of work that he did in the course of his career and knew a lot of very influential people and people who were in positions of power, and he found out a lot of information that is still kept secret and hidden from the public. That's something that I think eventually will come out, and it would be interesting to see how, if it will be some non-fiction thriller,
mm-hmm.
in some sort of exciting way. Who knows?
That you're going to write?
Oh, yes. Very competent at writing these sorts of books.
Well, we can't thank you enough for joining us today. It was wonderful to speak with you and about your father and all of these just fascinating mystical things.
And it sounds like there's still more out there to be discovered. So this concludes today's episode, but not our show. Matt, Noel, and I will be returning next week with more of the strangest, most bizarre stuff they don't want you to know. But in the meantime, if your question is, how can I find you guys before the next episode, check us out on the internet.
We got ways.
Yeah.
We got means.
You can find us on Twitter. We're Conspiracy Stuff there, and on Facebook. Same deal. Hey, Tansy, how can people find you and ask you questions if they're interested?
So I run my father's website, which is michaelbagent.com. So you can contact me through that website. Yeah, I'll happily answer any questions that you might have.
Is there anything else you're getting into that you want to tell people about?
Yeah, so I'm actually at the moment in the process of writing a book about the future of the environment. I did a master's in international environmental law, and it's something that's really interesting to me and also talks about a lot of conspiracies in that world.
Oh, that's awesome. Scary, too. Environmental conspiracies. I feel like that's going to make me really sad, Tansy. All right.
Well, Matt, gird yourself, get ready, because we're going to have to do an episode on that in the future.
Okay, I'm down.
And if none of that social media stuff is your bag, you can totally just send us an email with questions, concerns, comments, ideas for episodes, death threats. No, maybe not.
But don't do that.
Send them to conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.